And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Anne Gislason to the program today. Anne's writing has appeared in the Atlantic Monthly, the Oxford American, the Believer, and the Los Angeles Times, among others. Today we'll be talking about her first book, The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading, which is published by Little Brown. Anne, how did the Existential Crisis Reading Group come to be in the first place?
I remember it was the end of 2011. It was December. And Chris came over to our house and in kind of an agitated state. And I remember I was making dinner. He often shows up just kind of unannounced, just wanting to hang out and talk. And I have two kids. He's unattached and lives way more sort of flexible lifestyle. And I was cooking and he said, you know, I really want to get together with you and do some readings one-on-one, some philosophical readings and just like talk through things. And I was kind of overwhelmed with all my sort of other responsibilities, but I was totally willing to open it up to a more social situation. I mean, I was like, you know, if you want to do some sort of group, we could do it as a group. So my husband and I went to the Hot Wok Buffet that weekend with our kids. And as our kids were reading the buffet line, we came up with a list of friends. We started thinking about our friends, different people who might be interested in this endeavor. It wasn't going to be a self-help group. It wasn't going to be a book club. It would just be people who wanted to talk about basically existential issues in their lives or any kind of issues in their lives and this kind of search for meaning. We labored over this list and kind of pared it down, and we were surprised when we went to approach people how enthusiastic they were. Some said yes almost immediately, just a few words into it. After a while, it became a sort of self-selected group, people who weren't as interested in it. A couple of them just kind of left after the first couple meetings. They weren't getting what they wanted out of it, I guess. But we've had this core group of about 8 people for the last 5 years, and we still meet. And some people, we get new members, some people move away. But yeah, so it came out of this need from one person, but then we recognized that there seemed to be kind of a general need among a lot of people to get together and talk.
Now, is there kind of like a common personality trait amongst all the people in your group that you can kind of see a thread?
The only common personality thing I think would be curiosity and intellectual engagement and just really, really wanting to talk through these things. And seriously, although we have a really good time, you know, we drink a lot of wine and we have snacks and everything, and there's a lot of laughing, but there's also just a lot of serious engagement with the literature. So I think that would be the one common thing, because other than that, it's quite a variety of personalities, people who are really outgoing, people who are really more introverted. We had one member who just sat on the couch, didn't say anything for like the first 4 months, and it took her a while to open up. So I think that would be the intellectual engagement and willing to really confront these issues, I think, is probably the number one common trait.
And these aren't all academics either.
No. Actually, we only have one academic. We had two academics for a few meetings, and one of the academics dropped out. But yeah, we only have one academic, and that's kind of very much his role. He's got a much more of a wide-ranging knowledge of philosophical and psychological issues than the rest of us. The rest of us are just kind of lay people. We've got musicians, carpenters, poets, teachers, set painters. So yeah, there's a wide variety of people.
Now, the Futilitarians was a proposed name for the group when it first started. Why did you choose that for the name of the book instead of the Existential Crisis Reading Group?
Well, first of all, it's kind of a mouthful, Existential Crisis Reading Group. And frankly, marketing was a little leery about putting existential on the cover at all. And the Futilitarians, it seemed to embody the central project of the book more than any other title that we could come up with. I had a working title that I'd had for a long time, which I now see was not the best title, even though I was attached to it. But the Futilitarians, at first, it implies the group project, the plural. And also this sense, it's kind of like, it starts off as a joke, right? It's kind of this like central joke, the jokiness of the title, that we're born into this world with the knowledge of our own deaths, and then we're expected to just keep on keeping on despite all of that. So acknowledging this idea of futility as having a utilitarian value to it, like once you kind of confront that one central issue, then it kind of explodes open this possibility of creating meaning in your life.
Yeah, it seemed to be kind of a contrast between the Epicurean thought of kind of reducing the amount of pain possible, mm-hmm. as opposed to utilitarianism, where you're supposed to maximize the good for as many people possible.
Yeah, exactly.
Your book is ostensibly set up in chapters going by month in 2012, but so much of the book is you processing the coming and eventual death of your father and the deaths of your younger twin sisters, which had happened like a decade prior.
Right, roughly. Mm-hmm.
So even though it is set up by those months in 2012, are these ruminations about the deaths of your sister and the memories of your father and the family, were those what you were having at the time or since?
I mean, obviously, these are things I'd been thinking about for a while before the book club. It was the timing of the book club that we started the first week of January in 2012, and the next week my father died. And so that gave a completely different sort of depth and sense of urgency about the things that we were reading. And, you know, the death of a parent, it just kind of, it just opens up all of these questions. And, you know, you're closer to your own death and you think about your past a lot and your relationship with your, my case with my dad. And so the confluence of those two things together really kind of deepened me thinking about his loss and then past loss. And the other narrative component of that is that my father had always forbade me to write about the suicides of my younger sisters. You know, I didn't write about it. I didn't listen to him because it didn't seem worth it to create more pain in his life and my parents' life than they already had. But he told me specifically he would carry it to his grave and he would never forgive me if I wrote about them. And so once he died, you know, unfortunately, that was the thing that really freed me up to start writing about Rebecca and Rachel. So it was starting the existential crisis reading group, my father dying, and then that forbidden thing being lifted from the subject, that taboo being lifted from the subject of writing about my sisters. And so in thinking about the readings and then further in writing about the readings that we did, I really, really got to work through some things with my sister's death that I'd never confronted in myself before. So it was kind of a bunch of things that were working kind of in concert to bring this book about.
But it seems like it had been so tough since writing seems to be a big part of your identity and your sense of self, mm-hmm. to be denied access to that in order to process the deaths of your sisters.
Actually, that was part of the impetus for doing it. Once I realized that that was what was going on, that's why I kind of went for it, because I was denied access to that for so long. It was just unfortunate that it was that my father had to be gone before I could actually do those things. I wouldn't have preferred it that way, but that's just the way that it happened.
All of us suffer loss, mm-hmm. and may know the types of pain you're going through. What were the other types of situations some of the other members were dealing with during this time in 2012?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of them, just to stay sort of vague, because it's not something I talk about too much in the books, but one of our members was going through a divorce. Another was dealing with a son's addiction. One had just had another child, a second child, and was kind of struggling with the implications of that. Just kind of like general life things that made meeting once a month, this group, like knowing that you have the place where you can actually go and kind of face some things head on in a way that really engaged your mind and not just maybe whatever emotional stuff that you were dealing with at the time.
How can we look at positive events through an existentialist lens, not just the ones that kind of try our souls?
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. I think existentialism in itself is a very kind of positive mode of being. It's not nearly as kind of dark and nihilistic as a lot of people kind of perceive it to be. I think since it's so much about creating meaning through your actions and the way you are in the world, the questions that you ask, the things that you're engaged with, I think that anything positive that happens to you, you know, whether it's success or anything else, I think as long as you're creating meaning in the world, and especially for yourself, then I think that that's a positive lens. Not sure how to phrase this question.
I'm sorry, that's a tough one. I should ask you what the meaning of life was.
but it's interesting to think about, because I think that they are. I think that those two almost merge in a way. Because that means that you're being successful, like existentials are really into having people buy into your project, whatever your project or your idea is. Especially Simone de Beauvoir was really into that. And the more people you can have participate in your view, kind of the more successful and positive things are. So I think positive things happening in your life is kind of absolutely part of an existential way of being, because you're being active and engaged with the world. Does that make sense?
It does. But talking about people buying into your projects, does that then put so much importance on providing context for people?
In what way?
Well, if for people to buy in, they have to connect you in some way.
Yeah.
And in order, you have to find those points of connection between people in order to then attract them into the project.
Right.
That you can't just be, an island into yourself or sui generis. You have to have connection to the world in order to invite those people in.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't even necessarily agree with that as being a necessary mode of being, because not everyone's equipped to be like that. You know, Voltaire had said, you know, everyone needs to tend to his own garden.
Make our gardens grow.
Yeah,
Candide, yeah.
Yeah. But de Beauvoir pointed out that, like, not everybody can do that. For some people, a flower pot is too much to take care of. And for other people, want to, like, plow the earth with their project and with their ambition. So she didn't think that that was a very useful metaphor. And I don't think having other people buy into your whatever your project is necessarily anything that everybody has to aspire to, because that's not everybody's way of being, you know?
You write a couple of times about how your family dinners when you were younger were kind of like an interrogation, or more like a seminar class in university. Do you think that the reading group was some way an attempt to recreate that kind of dynamic with a large group of people talking seriously about issues that you weren't getting because your family unit had become such a smaller thing than 8 kids and a couple of parents?
You know what? That's so interesting. I'd never even thought about that. And that's such an obvious connection that I didn't see myself. But yeah, absolutely. It was something that I valued so much. And yeah, our family unit is much smaller and the kids are kind of farther apart in age, about 7 years apart in age. But growing up, my parents had 8 kids in 8 years. And so we were all really close in age. And so the opportunity for this kind of more dynamic conversation was always very, very present. And so I never thought about it, but I guess that makes perfect sense. And especially since, like, most of the time around in our living room, around the table, there's about 10 people, which is the number of people that we grew up with too. I imagine something in me still kind of hungers for that. And I'm glad that I found a good group of people to sort of recreate that.
Because it seems like something that we're losing with smaller families over the years is losing extended families and losing a lot of personal interaction, even with inside the same house.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's one of the reasons why we limit screen times and no screens at the kitchen table. And actually in my house, even though we're a smaller unit with kind of the kids are a little farther apart, like we still sit down to dinner, all 4 of us, almost every night, and just have that moment to connect face to face with no screens and talk through things that happened during the day. So that's still so important.
But 8 kids in 8 years. I know, I know the term has come under a little bit of controversy lately with Irish octuplets.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
One of the big themes you talk about in the book is this big swath of your father's life that your mother really had no knowledge of. Mm-hmm. What was your mother's reaction after your father had passed and she found out that he had these chunks of life that people seemed to be involved in, and they weren't nefarious or anything, mm-hmm. but it was just completely unknown to her?
My mom and I meet for breakfast once a week. Every Friday we meet for breakfast. And so, like, once again, we have this kind of carved out sacrosanct time to talk. After my dad died, she was in the position she had to pay bills and do things that she had never done before. She had never used an ATM card before. She always had cash. Either she would go to the bank and use a check, or dad would give her cash. And so she was confronted with things that she had never dealt with over her entire adult life. You know, she never asked about finances. She didn't ask about a lot of things. And over those breakfasts with my mom, we talked through a lot of these things. And there was so much that she just didn't know about how he spent his time, or, you know, what was going on with the finances, or any of that stuff. And they seemed to live these parallel lives. And, you know, finally one day I asked her about that, why she kind of wasn't more kind of curious about what was happening in his life. And the answer was not what I expected. Her answer was that, you know, he got engaged and married right after college and immediately started law school. They had 3 kids while he was finishing law school, and he was working. So he was in law school and working, clerking at a job, and had 3 kids. And then we moved, and, you know, more kids. And when life did kind of open up a little bit for him, My mom's just like, she wanted him to have time to himself that he never had as a young man. So she was kind of giving him that space, giving him that sort of sense of freedom for him to kind of go do whatever it was that he felt like he needed to do, because he had never had the opportunity for that. And I thought that it was a kind of very generous attitude, even though I think when those habits were set up over the decades, because this did go on for decades, I think once he was gone, she wished she had asked him more questions and had been more inquiring about things. But also, she was raising 8 children on her own. That was the other thing. She said she just didn't notice things, too. Like, she was just so busy with the kids, and he was working all the time, too. So I think she regrets that kind of disconnect. But I think it was just, once again, it was this pattern over decades that happened.
But did she not have that same desire for her own personal time that she was giving him?
I mean, honestly, I think we did talk about that. She was so into raising the kids, and she just loved being a mom, and she loved being around the children. I think once we got older, she started taking more time for herself. And she's, my God, she is in like 4 book clubs. She goes to theater all the time. She's always going to symphonies. And so, and she was doing more of that towards the end of my dad's life too. So I think it's her, I mean, you know how families evolve and, you know, children grow up and you get more time. And I think as she got older and we were gone, she definitely took more time for herself. But when we were kids, I never even thought about her having any kind of a private life or a private self that didn't have to do with us, because she was always there for us all the time. Whereas my dad was always not there for us, you know. He was often absent.
Now, in the later parts of your father's career, he worked as death row legal counsel. Mm-hmm. And your father seemed to have a very strong and fast commitment toward justice.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was doing the death penalty work pro bono, so he was still doing the kind of the corporate stuff as well. This was an aspect of him that he talked about with such passion. He would never talk about any of the other corporate stuff that he was doing, but this is something that stayed steadfast with him for as long as I have any kind of memory of him speaking and talking to us, was that the sense of justice and right and wrong. And this kind of goes back to our dinners as well, when he would put something out there. A lot of these discussions were couched as moral arguments too. My parents were also very Catholic, and so things like the death penalty or abortion. I think having a father who was so passionately preoccupied with this idea of justice on any level was something that stuck with us from childhood and that we still have a great passion for. My younger brother, he also does pro bono death penalty work. And all of us work in different social justice areas today, but it's something that's always been present in a very forceful way in terms of like our family dynamic and in terms of our education and growing up. So he was always, I think, just a really kind of intense influence when it came to the way that we think about the world and kind of on a daily basis. And living in New Orleans, like, you have tons of opportunity to think about injustice and the way things are played out in the world.
Did you feel that your parents were particularly just in the way they handled discipline in the house?
Well, no, because I used to complain all the time that, you know, you treat us all differently. Like, you know, someone gets a lighter punishment, someone gets a heavier punishment. You treat us all differently. And my dad said, of course I treat you all differently. You're all different people. He said, it wouldn't make sense for me to treat you, everybody, exactly the same. So he wasn't an absolutist when it came to that.
You mentioned your brother, who also handles pro bono death penalty cases. I believe his name was Soren, mm-hmm, named after Soren Kierkegaard.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So while the rest of you had fairly standard biblical-oriented uh-huh names, a philosophical influence does run through the family.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think Dad kind of slipped that in there on purpose, too. The thing I say in the book is kind of a measure. Like, even though we were brought up in a very Catholic household, you know, Kierkegaard was very into doubt and questioning as being an important part of faith. And Dad was often a contrarian and often a doubter, and especially when it came to establishments like the church or government. So I think, like, embracing a faith as strongly as the family embraced Catholicism, but also having that check, that sense of you have to keep questioning things.
And we can see what adherence to dogma is doing to our country right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Now, how did y'all go about selecting the works you would read each month?
Well, it started off, Chris chose the first 2 readings in January. It was Epicurus and Ecclesiastes. And then during that meeting, we said, oh, one person in particular said, oh, he thought a good follow-up would be a selection from American Existentialism and today's Borofsky's This Way to the Gas, Ladies and Gentlemen, is kind of to give a little more narrative quality because the readings had been pretty abstract for that first one. And so that's kind of the way it happened, that month to month, the next month's reading would kind of arise from the discussion, like whatever spoke to that month's reading or in reaction to that month's reading or just seemed like a good companion or a departure or something. So the following month's reading always just kind of came up organically in reaction to whatever the current meeting was. So that way the conversation kind of keeps ratcheting forward month after month and now year after year because we've been doing it for 5 years now. And so like we can trace more or less the readings all the way back to Ecclesiastes and Epicurus.
Drinking is part of the title, but mm-hmm. it really doesn't take up too much of the book.
Okay. My mom didn't think so. My mom was horrified by the amount of drinking in the book.
Well, one night a month for a year.
Yeah, I think more is implied, though.
Well, and there was discussion of your father's drinking, which he kept secret from your mother as well.
Mm-hmm. There is a chapter called The Metaphysical Hangover, in which that's kind of addressed head on in terms of the prominence that drinking takes in the group and how we know how damaging, everyone recognizes how damaging drinking can be. And then we go back to Epicurus, who was all about moderation, like everything in moderation, not excess. And also in that chapter, we talk about the benefits, the kind of the communal benefits of everybody kind of partaking. It almost becomes almost like sacramental or something. Everybody shows up with the bottle, drain the bottles. We always line up the bottles on the side of the wall to kind of get them out of the way. So it does become like part of just the ritual of meeting and talking. And I mean, people have been doing it for thousands of years.
Now, there was a literary form that I had never heard of that you discussed later in the book. It's called a chronica.
Oh, yeah.
And you talk about Clarice Lispector.
For me, that was one of the more revelatory readings that we did. I had been unfamiliar with the chronica, too, until someone had just told me about them randomly. And then Michael, in that last month in December, ended up choosing them for the last month, for our last reading of the year. And I'm so glad it was the last reading of the year, because it seemed like this kind of culmination. A chronica is a form of Brazilian, I guess it's unique to Brazilian journalism, in that it's like a daily column or something. But the writers who were doing it were often very literary writers, and like Clarice Lispector, and they were given total freedom. And they were given freedom of style, freedom of content. They could basically say whatever wild stuff came into their heads. And it was printed in the daily paper. And I think one of the reasons that I loved ending the year with Clarice Lispector was this kind of like this fearless quality she had of talking about life and things that were so hard to talk about. But she was doing it in a newspaper in like this totally democratic form. Like she'd start off one saying, I wake up in a rage. And then she would just talk about how angry and mad she is at the world. Yeah. And so it was just this great, like I said, it was this great form that kind of burst the boundaries of what we would consider kind of standard newspaper journalism. And so it's collected, the Clarice Lispector ones that she was doing, writing are collected in just selected chronicas. They were done largely towards the end of her life when, you know, she was thinking more and more about mortality and the nature of being and everything. And so, yeah, that's some of my favorite readings that we did were those chronicas.
Because, I mean, they almost kind of presage the coming of the blog, in a way, the personal blog.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about it, but it's, yeah, the way that they're just these very short, intense, personal bursts that come from deep within.
And it seems interesting that you could have so many different ways of reading them, in that maybe you took the paper every day and you kind of get this accumulated knowledge of mm-hmm. her writing and herself. And so you can kind of see this internal conversation that's going on all along. Or if you just happen to pick up a paper once every couple of weeks and you just see this out of context and how that could be such a different experience for the readers.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. But I think if anything, it kind of pulls you out of the everydayness of the newspaper, where, you know, you're getting your news, you're getting the sales, you're getting the sports stats, you're getting all this stuff. And then you get this moment of connecting to something like totally intense and personal and essential or universal. Kind of wish we had more of that in our life. And I think that's even harder and harder these days, as we just have this deluge of information and words and images, but not many that can really kind of like sear into into your interior and really just kind of like make you think about what's going on around you. Instead, you end up feeling kind of drowned in everything that's happening.
In choosing just to cover calendar 2012, do you remember much about January 2013 and what you were feeling at that time?
That is very interesting because the book ends technically in January 1st. It starts in Epiphany, but yeah, it ends, you know, like New Year's early morning, like after midnight on New Year's in January. And that was such a dramatic New Year's. Like I really do feel like I'd made it through something because that would have been a year of, you know, grieving my father, a year of having this group together that had meant so much to me. And I remember in that January, we were assessing, it's like, we've done this for a year. We've done this experiment. Like, do we keep going with this? And I was like, please, yes, let's keep going with this group because it's meant so much to me and to a lot of other people. And so we did keep doing it. But I don't even know. I don't even know what we read that. I'd have to like look up in my little log what we read in that. No one's ever asked me about January 2013. But it did feel like kind of a new start, like a new chapter. And that's kind of, I think, one of the points of the book is that like we live our lives according to these like calendars and structures. And those things hold so much meaning, like the month holds meaning, the year holds meaning. And, you know, in the Catholic liturgical calendar, like there's so much meaning embedded into that. And it's an entirely human construct. Like this is just a construct we create for ourselves. But it kind of works in terms of being a container for the chaos that is our lives. And so New Year's morning on 2013, I can feel like that there was like something did occur, like there was some sort of semblance of structure and development. You know what I mean? Like over the year, like something did happen. I think it keeps us from kind of going a little bonkers too.
Now, when did the actual idea for writing The Futilitarians come to you? Was it sometime after 2012 or in the midst of it?
It was definitely in the midst of it because after that first month where so much happened, where we started the group, my father died, and there were so many connections that I was drawing between all of those things. And I write a lot of essays, and I always know that I want to write something when there are a few things that I'm experiencing or witnessing that are all connected and that all come together, but I'm not sure exactly how. And so the essay is figuring out how these things all connect and work with each other and what those connections mean. And so that happened early on because I wrote an essay after the January meeting. It's like, oh, I'm going to write an essay about what it was like starting an existential crisis reading group and reading this Ecclesiastes and Epicurus and then having my father die and having to deal with all of that all at once. And I started writing. I'm like, And then the next month we did, you know, the Tadeusz Borowski and more stuff happened. And then the next month, I was like, wow, there's so much here. And I think it was about halfway through, about 6 months into it, I asked the group's permission. I was like, do y'all care if I write about this? Because I didn't want to skew the dynamic. We had a very natural and wonderful dynamic between everybody. And I didn't want to skew it by putting a sort of like documentary, like you're being observed kind of element to it. But everybody was very cool about it. And they still are.
I'm assuming you probably turned in the book in 2016 for its final edits. So what was the life of the book in 2013 through 2016? Do you think anything that happened along in that time started to change your perspective of 2012? Or were you trying to be honest to the moment of 2012?
You know what? At first I was trying to be honest to the moment of it. And then later some things happened. And I thought, you know what, like this is something I would go back to it. And I say, this is something I feel like I really need to emphasize. So I think it's hard, like whenever you're writing something, it's so hard to be like true to the moment because you're in a different moment. And so like how do you be true to the moment that you're writing? Like me at my desk in 2015, looking back at me in 2012, those are two different me's having two different experiences. And the writing of it kind of reconciles those, if that makes sense. Like reconciling those two different parts of you. Like part of me hopes like I never want to, the way in which I wrote some of those, like just like this very intense kind of overblown grief of that moment. It's like, I hope I never have to write like that ever again. Yeah.
So In looking so closely at 1 year in your life, do you think you missed anything in those intervening years while getting the book done, that it occupied so much of your headspace that you may have not been taking advantage of the present along those years?
Yeah. Actually, I know it because I was just thinking about this the other day. It's like when you have kids, they grow up really, they grow up like really freaking quickly. Like suddenly I have a kid in sixth grade and suddenly I have a kid who's a senior in high school and applying for colleges. And then like in the book, they're so much younger. I mean, like really younger. Kids can change so quickly in such a short period of time. And at the same time, like while you're writing a book, like your head is so deeply in that book and in that project. I become very distracted, terrible driver, you know, just like when I'm working on some big project like that, probably not the best mom all the time. There are things I missed along the way. I feel like I just like lifted my head. I'm like, oh my God, the kids, they're like, look at them now. They're in this wholly different phase. And I think I might've missed something. And I'm worried that I missed some things along the way that I wasn't as present for them as I could have been.
Now, you're a New Orleans native and you live there still. What thoughts and ideas do you have to offer to the people of Houston? Because we're recording this at the end of August as the hurricane has just flooded Houston and much of the Texas coast. Since you went through Katrina, what do you think maybe existentialism can offer them at some point in the future after the hard work of rebuilding is doing, or what to sustain them during the hard work that's coming?
I think right now, like literally as we're talking, people are still being rescued and still being pulled from the water, from rooftops. And like at this moment right now, I think with everything being so raw and what I recall from that time, like there's not much that I can, like there's almost like nothing that can be expressed right now to them that would, I think, bring much comfort. I think when you're like in the middle of the trauma, and just trying to figure out the next thing. And just, there's so much shock and disbelief. But I think like a moment like this, words fail and actions are kind of everything that count. And I think as the long, long haul, this will go on years, it'll go on decades. I think one of the things that I do kind of actually miss from the immediate time after Katrina was this absolute shared sense of purpose and community that people had in the aftermath in those first few years. It was really incredibly wonderful and inspiring to see people like actively said, we are going to rebuild. Like we have this common home that we care about so much that we want to try to bring back. People who didn't have that same passion left town. And then other people who did have a passion for it moved to town. And so I think that there was this moment where there were so many wonderful things happening and so much energy and just there's so much connection. I think what I miss in the aftermath was the connection that people from different neighborhoods, social strata, everything, like people just were coming together. And I just felt like such a connection to the place and to the people. At this point, like saying like, that's what you have to look forward to sounds a little crass, but I think in a situation like this, where humanity really shows itself for what it, in a way, like what the best it could be. I mean, this is a natural disaster. You know, we could talk about the man-made implications of it, but just, it's kind of a rare moment of people uniting that I think I miss from those first years afterwards. There was a kind of clarity to living in that moment when you're just thinking about survival and rebuilding and your home and your family. And then all of that kind of, you know, things become normal and more normalized and after several years. But I like to think that people who went through Katrina will always have this like this strong, strong memory of the things that people did for each other and kind of the potential for people helping other people and the potential for the kind of like strength and to use the word resilience, even though Houstonians, you will get very tired of hearing the word resilience over the next few years. Yeah, it's an extraordinary gift that I wouldn't want to wish on anybody.
And just now thinking about the strange difference in the word existential in dealing with philosophical concept is so completely different from something, say, an existential threat, an immediate bodily threat on somebody.
Yeah.
It just seems strange that that one word encapsulates the immediate physical and then the concept of the meaning of life, essentially.
Yeah, it's true, because I think that the idea of the existential threat, which these threat to your very existence, it tends to kind of sharpen your brain. It sharpens your instincts and your thoughts. Like, this is what I have to do to survive, and this is why I want to survive. So I think that those two are connected in that way.
Once an existential threat has passed, then existentialism becomes the way to process it.
Yeah. I think maybe that's what that book is all about. I think you just said what I was trying to say in the opening chapter is about how this was the moment, like all these things had happened over the years. And this was kind of like the aftermath. Like this is, we finally had a moment to kind of slow down and take stock and figure out what we're doing here and why we're doing it.
Now, the most cited work, I think, in the readings for 2012 was the Concise Dictionary of Existentialism. What part does a reference book play in existentialism?
Oh, for me, it was extremely, extremely handy because I don't, you know, I am not a professor of philosophy. I've read some existential literature, but, you know, I haven't like studied it in depth. It's great having this like handy little book from like 1961, this tiny little hardback that's kind of falling apart at this point. Just lists everything from Americanism to being to nothingness, women, war, youth, children, anxiety, anguish. And you could just go and just find a fantastic quote from Sartre or Simone de Beauvoir or somebody. Like it was just very handy to have something like that you could just like open to and then just find a quote and be inspired by that quote. And these quotes are always kind of these like mind-blowing open kind of quotes. But they're in this very unassuming, alphabetically organized little gray book. So yeah, having a reference was very handy for me.
What projects are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm working on a sort of, I don't know if it's a related book or what, but it occurred to me I'd done a lot of writings about bars, about growing up in bars in New Orleans, and about drinking and the role that that plays in our lives and our settler, maybe not everybody's life, in my life and other people I know lives. And so, just the space of the bar, how I've always found that such an edifying kind of space. And I'm so interested in that. And so what I'm working on now is a nonfiction book about certain bars and drinking. And
so have you gotten a case of Beefeater Gin after the publication of the book?
No, but I did have a nice Beefeater Martini at the Rib Room last week.
Well, Anne, I want to thank you so much for stopping by and sharing your book with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And thanks for your patience.
Oh, sure. Like I said, I just hope you can get something good out of it.
This is such a technological snake bite. Anne Gislason is the author of The Futilitarians, Our Year of Thinking, Drinking, Grieving, and Reading, which is published by Little Brown. I'm Stephen Usry, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.